Hello, this is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service with reports and analysis from across the world. The latest news 7 days a week. BBC World Service podcasts are supported by advertising.
Because you listen to this show, Babbel has a very special offer for you. Go to babbel.com and select the language of your choice. Once you try for free and are ready to sign up, select the 3-month option and Babbel will give you 3 additional months for free with promo code BABBELNEWS. That's right. You will get 6 months for the cost of 3 with promo code BABBELNEWS. Go to babbel.com and enter promo code BABBELNEWS. Babbel. Speak a new language with confidence.
This is the Global News Podcast from the BBC World Service. Hello, I'm Oliver Conway, and this edition is published in the early hours of Tuesday, the 22nd of October. Our main stories: the Israeli Prime Minister fails to form a government after the recent election deadlock. His rival now gets to try. The biggest protests in Lebanon in more than a decade continue despite the government announcing emergency reforms. And the UK still doesn't know how or if it will leave the EU in 9 days after the government fails in its latest attempt to hold a vote in Parliament. Also in this podcast, we hear how African doctors are being trained to find and excavate human remains. And
I will never forget that moment coming out the hatch and looking down and seeing just my boots and the earth below.
What it was like to make history in space. The Israeli Prime Minister Benjamin Netanyahu has failed in his attempt to form a coalition government after last month's election ended in deadlock. He's been in power for the past decade, but was unable to convince his rivals to back him. He made the announcement in a video on his official Facebook page.
A short time ago, I informed the president that I was handing back my mandate to try to form a government. Ever since I received the mandate, I acted non-stop, both openly and secretly, in order to form a wide national unity government. This is what the people want. This is also what Israel needs in the face of the security challenges, which grow bigger daily and hourly.
Mr. Netanyahu's main political opponent, Benny Gantz, will now get his turn to try to form a government. If he fails, it could lead to yet another election. With more details, our correspondent Tom Bateman in Jerusalem.
It was clear since the result of Israel's second inconclusive election this year that there was no obvious way for Mr. Netanyahu to form a fresh coalition. But he has strung out his chance at trying for almost as long as possible. He cannot muster the necessary 61-seat majority for a right-wing bloc in the Israeli parliament. He issued a video accusing his main rival, Benny Gantz, of failing to negotiate with him. Mr. Gantz leads a right-of-centre alliance and is now set for his turn, 28 days to try to form a coalition. But he too does not have any clear route to a majority government. Israel's president has suggested a so-called unity coalition of the two main parties, which could see Mr. Gantz as de facto prime minister, while Mr. Netanyahu holds on to the position in name only. He is facing looming corruption charges, which he denies. Many in Israel believe a third election may be the only way to break the deadlock.
Tom Bateman. Hundreds of thousands of protesters in Lebanon stayed on the streets on Monday despite the government approving a package of reforms aimed at winning them over. In a televised speech, the Prime Minister, Saad Hariri, acknowledged their right to demonstrate.
These measures are not a bargain, not to ask you to go home or to stop demonstrating or expressing your anger. You have the say, and no one will give you any time limit or ultimatum, and I will not accept any threats or intimidation towards you. It's the duty of the state to safeguard your demands and to protect you so long as you're demonstrating peacefully.
The protests, which united people across deep sectarian lines, began over plans to tax WhatsApp calls. But when that was scrapped, people turned their anger on government corruption, economic mismanagement and poor public services. And the reform package has done little to change their view. As I heard from our correspondent in Beirut, Rami Ruhayem.
The immediate reaction was one of ridicule towards the statement. The central issue is an issue of trust. So the people on the streets simply don't trust the government to carry out any reforms, even if they agree with them. And we really don't know whether they agree with everything that was announced. Some measures will probably be popular, such as making the banks contribute towards bringing down the budget deficit, because one of the main problems in Lebanon is a huge ballooning public debt from which the banks have profited hugely since the early 1990s. So this would be a popular measure. It is an exceptional measure announced only for the 2020 budget. So it will not solve the wider issue resulting from the huge debt that Lebanon has to pay. Other measures will not necessarily be ones that have the unanimous support of everybody in the street. But again, it's an issue of trust. People know that none of these measures were going to be announced were it not for the intense pressure that the government was under because of the protests. The government was going towards taxes on the poor, taxes that disproportionately affect the poor, and they were not going to even consider increasing taxes on the banks, for example.
And what is it about the way that the country is governed that angers people so much?
Corruption, waste are two things, but there are also deeper issues, such as the huge public debt, which was supposed to go towards reconstruction after the civil war, but the services are very poor, infrastructure is very bad, the electricity provision is way below what it should be, given that so much time has passed since the civil war and so much money has been spent on the electricity sector. There are other issues with almost every single aspect of government services, which are supposed to be in a much better state in a country like Lebanon, given the amount of money that has come into the country since the civil war and given the amount of time that has passed. There aren't many excuses as to why the government services are so poor and infrastructure is in such a bad state. And also the very nature of the political system, which is basically a sectarian system in which rival factions carve out the state and try to gain political support by carving up the state and distributing the money and public sector jobs to their supporters.
The Prime Minister's praised the demonstrators for breaking down sectarian barriers. Could this protest actually work to bring them down within the government?
No, this is very unlikely. In fact, divisions within the government are at an all-time high, and different factions are trying to use the protests in their own internal squabbling. And that's probably one of the biggest threats that the nationwide movement faces right now, is that the longer it lasts, on one hand, the longer the pressure on the government lasts, but on the other, the more opportunities the different factions within the government and outside the government even will have in order to try to make, to put a sectarian spin on this movement and try to use it to their own advantages.
Rami Ruhayem talking to me from Beirut. After more than 3 years, the battle over Brexit is reaching a climax. But with only 9 days to go until the UK is due to leave the European Union, we still don't know what will happen. A deal, no deal, or a delay. On Saturday, the UK Parliament voted not to authorise the deal renegotiated by Boris Johnson until the laws needed to implement it are passed. But the government wanted to give MPs another chance to say yes on Monday. The Speaker, John Bercow, said that would break the rules, as our political correspondent Norman Smith reports.
The Speaker's decision to rebuff Boris Johnson's attempt to have a second go at his meaningful vote may not have been a surprise, but it nevertheless prompted fury within government. Number 10 accused the Speaker of denying Parliament a chance to deliver on the will of the people. The ruling also led to a series of personal attacks on the Speaker from Tory MPs angry at what they perceived as his bias against the government. In a lengthy and combative response, Mr. Bercow insisted holding a vote on the same motion as that debated on Saturday would flout Commons rules. There had also, he said, been no change in the circumstances since the first vote. And Mr. Bercow chided the government for failing to show proper respect for decisions taken by the Commons.
In summary, today's motion is in substance the same as Saturday's motion, and the House has decided the matter. Today's circumstances are in substance the same as Saturday's circumstances. My ruling is therefore that the motion will not be debated today, as it would be repetitive and disorderly to do so.
His ruling prompted a barrage of complaints from aggrieved Tory Brexiteers, among them the Conservative chairman of the Public Administration Committee, Superna Jenkin, who said he would be holding an inquiry into the role of the Speaker.
I note the dilemmas you face mean that on occasion you will sometimes have to please some and not others, but it is becoming remarkable how often you please one lot and not the other lot.
Thwarted from holding a second meaningful vote, the government tonight announced it would begin the process tomorrow of trying to push the legislation to implement Mr Johnson's deal through Parliament by the end of the week in order to meet his deadline of October the 31st. Ministers remain confident they do now have the support to get their Brexit bill through the Commons and believe they're poised to win the symbolic second reading vote tomorrow. However, with the numbers so tight and the DUP still bitterly opposed, the eventual outcome in the Commons is almost impossible to predict.
Norman Smith reporting. And if you have any questions about Brexit, do email them to us, globalpodcast@bbc.co.uk, and we'll put them to the BBC Brexit cast team in a special edition of the Global News podcast. For hundreds of thousands of people in Africa, the pain of losing a loved one in conflict is made worse by the fact that their body is never found. But now forensic experts from Argentina, together with the International Committee of the Red Cross, have been training professionals from across the continent on how to find and excavate remains. The BBC's Valdi Karels reports from South Africa.
With birds circling above, the spades hit dirt and then bone.
Have a body bag. We'll bring the body down. Let us clear that, place. Yeah.
Hidden in a shallow grave, doctors from different African countries find what they've spent most of the morning searching for.
Now we reach the level, we find some skull, and still we are digging.
On the grounds of a mortuary in Pretoria, there are now several open graves. Some of the remains are tied together with belts. Others are just bone fragments. Each have their own story to tell, how they lived, but most importantly, how they died. Dr. Ijeoma Okoli is a family physician in Nigeria. She's helping the health ministry draw up policy around forensic medical services.
Right now, our forensic capability is at a very low level. And because of that, a lot of crimes are not really solved. I think the most interesting thing I've learned is that crime cases can really be solved. In my country, most of the time, it's interrogations, interviews. It's really not as scientific as it should be.
It's the only course of its kind on the continent.
We don't need to dig more inside, Tabu.
Huh?
Okay.
We don't need
well, to we have inside. Been working in Africa since 1994. We came first to work to Ethiopia after Mengistu fall. And then along the years, we were working in 17 African countries, investigating cases or providing training, what they call building local capacity in a south-south perspective.
Louis Fondabreda is the director of the Argentine Forensic Anthropology Team, an organization founded more than 30 years ago to document human rights violations through science. The skills they teach are particularly important for a continent still grappling with a number of ongoing conflicts. Dr. Peter Cirilio is from South Sudan.
In the context of our country, it's not that stable. Many wars are going there. Sometimes people are missing, and this course is very good. Yeah, it can help a lot.
This is sacrum.
From a mock crime scene to the lab, students are exposed to all facets of forensic anthropology.
On the plastic table in front of me are human remains. All of the bones are marked. The students aren't just required to dig up the bones. They're also required to put the skeleton back together again and analyze it.
Claudia Bisu from the Argentine forensic team says there aren't many forensic anthropologists in Africa. That's something they hope to change.
I hope that they will learn the techniques and they will apply it in their own context when they go back to their countries. And even if it's a skeleton, it's still a human being. It's a person, or it was a person, with a name, with a story. It's not just bones.
Dr. Okoli now knows every one of the bones she handles is a critical piece of the puzzle.
I think in Africa, burials are important. We have a proverb that says that it hurts really bad until you bury. And so as long as that body is somewhere in the mortuary or you don't even know where the body is, you're going to keep hurting.
Dr. Ijeoma Okoli, ending that report from Valde Caralsa. And still to come in the podcast.
Your addiction. I have cried because of you. I have been bullied because of you. You tore apart my family. Why mine? Signed, an upset child.
The children affected by the opioid crisis in America. President Trump has said that the Kurds in northeastern Syria are withdrawing intelligently a day before a Turkish ceasefire is due to end. His surprise decision to pull American troops out of Syria is seen as having cleared the way for Turkey to launch an offensive against Kurdish fighters there. On Monday, Mr. Trump said the US had never agreed to protect them forever. But as US armoured vehicles withdrew from the Kurdish-majority city of Qamishli, they were pelted with potatoes and stones. Our correspondent Barbara Platt-Usher is on the Turkish side of the border.
The US military convoys got an angry send-off. People hurled potatoes and shouted, "No America! America liar! America is running away like rats!" The Kurds were stunned by President Trump's decision 2 weeks ago to pull out of the border area with Turkey, leaving Kurdish militias exposed to a Turkish offensive. Ankara has long regarded them as terrorists because of their links to Kurdish insurgents in Turkey. Mark Esper said the U.S. withdrawal would take weeks, not days.
Until that time, our forces will remain in the towns that are located near the oil fields. A purpose of those forces, working with the SDF, is to deny access to those oil fields by ISIS and others.
Mr. Esper explained the president might decide to leave a skeleton force of a few hundred troops to guard Syria's oil fields and prevent a resurgence of the Islamic State group. He rejected charges of abandoning the Kurds. He said America's military relationship with them had always been about defeating IS militants and not about fighting a long-standing NATO ally like Turkey to help the Syrian Kurds achieve autonomy, something they had worked towards under the protective umbrella of the U.S. military.
Barbara Platt-Usher. According to the World Health Organization and UNICEF, 785 million people do not have access to clean water near their home. But this problem is now a bit closer to being solved, thanks to a young Indian architect who's working on an environmentally friendly algae-based filtration system called Indus. Shneel Malik is part of a team at the Bio-Integrated Design Lab at University College London. She spoke to Alan Kasuja about her research.
Indus is a modular wall designed to clean polluted water. It's constructed from tiles, and the idea is that you assemble a one-time installation structure, which is comparatively low cost and can be constructed by small-scale communities themselves. It could be a wooden batten structure or a metal framework, and you clip on these tiles onto the system to assemble into a wall. The tiles are then applied with this biomaterial, which has microalgae, and then you circulate water through it. While the water flows over these tiles, the microalgae is able to take up the heavy metal as food in from the wastewater, leaving behind comparatively cleaner water.
And what do you see as the potential benefits of this compared to the current filtration systems that are commonly used?
So this is very important because in 2017, as part of a Global Challenges Research Fund project, we traveled to India and visited small-scale artisan workers to better understand their existing scenarios of how they treat water. And we realized that these small-scale, very indigenous communities have no facilities of filtering or treating their water. And all they do is dig a sand pit near their industry or where they work and simply tip the polluted water, which then pollutes the surface and the existing groundwater table. And of course, then the impacts on the health of the community overall. So the idea is that a system like Indus can actually be taught to these small-scale artisans, and they can maintain and construct their own Indus wall to be able to treat and recycle and reuse the treated water within their system.
So for that to be achieved, it has to be affordable, doesn't it?
Yes, and that's why this is designed to be constructed by locally available materials and fabrication techniques.
But where do you see Indus being rolled out? Which parts of the world?
So for now, we hope that at least in developing countries where there are communities that are producing large amounts of polluted water. So we're hoping to empower these communities with a tool like Indus.
Shneel Malik. Four large drug companies have reached a legal settlement of $260 million with two counties in the state of Ohio for their role in the US opioid addiction epidemic. The drug companies, three American and one Israeli, agreed to the payment just hours before a trial that had been seen as a test case for more than 2,000 lawsuits. Over the past two decades, there have been more than 400,000 opioid-related deaths in the US, with one American now dying every 11 minutes because of opioids. The BBC's Sarah Svoboda visited a children's camp in Maryland that helps those whose families are struggling with opioid addiction.
My name is Jacob. I'm 12 years old.
My name is Kira, and I'm 11 years old.
Dear addiction.
Dear addiction.
Why did you turn my parents into something that they're not?
You tore apart my family. Why mine?
I don't know my own father because of you.
I've been lied to because of you.
I couldn't have a normal childhood or life because of you.
Signed, an upset child.
And when I had them write letters to addiction, one of them talked about, I hope at some point somebody's able to make this stop. And so I want to be that person who makes this stop. My name is Jan Brown. I am the program partner for Camp Spirit Song.
All right, go ahead and have a seat. Every one of us has a parent, close friend, or relative whose drug abuse upsets us. Go ahead.
My mom doesn't really say anything about my dad doing drugs. Really doesn't say anything about my dad. But once I asked her why my dad leave, and she just like says he's always a bad person, and I just stop asking that question.
My dad would bring like needles into the house. And then my friends, when they come over, they're like, what's that? And I would like be embarrassed to bring any more friends over.
All right, show of hands. Do you have a parent, close friend, or relative who has died from drug abuse? So we got 100% of hands. Does anybody want to talk about that?
I mean, I know people that overdosed and died. Mm-hmm. And you shouldn't go to rest like that. You should go to rest in a peaceful way.
So that's why we're doing this work, right? Is because all of us have those very, very, very hard and tragic things in common. So hopefully having conversations like this will help you feel better about yourselves and help you feel and know that you're not alone.
They just need one person who is going to be willing to listen to them, who is going to be essentially a safe person, because their families, I mean, are pretty broken.
Camp is really fun because I don't really like play at home, and I could tell like all my feelings to people because I trust them.
I mean, these friends here have an impact on me to listen, have fun, as much fun as possible while I'm a kid, and there is more people like me.
I can't even imagine what they're living through. Just hearing their stories, it shouldn't be that way. But there is always hope. There is always hope. I mean, you can see it in their eyes. I mean, if nothing more than seeing that, it's all worth it.
Sanctuary. That report by Sarah Svoboda. And we end this edition of the podcast with news from space. US astronauts Christina Cook and Jessica Meir have held a press conference live from the International Space Station after completing the first ever all-women spacewalk. The newsroom's Beth Timmins reports.
US astronauts Christina Cook and Jessica Meir made history on Friday when they stepped outside the International Space Station on the first all-female spacewalk.
We hope that we can provide an inspiration to everybody, not only women, but to everybody that has a dream, that has a big dream, and that is willing to work hard to make that dream come true.
Today, they told Earth what it felt like, addressing a news conference while floating weightless in orbit. Jessica spoke live on NASA TV.
It was really an incredible experience, and it's difficult to put it into words, the mixture of emotions and feelings that you have when you're going out the door the first time. And Christina and I have both been training together for over 6 years now, but I will never forget that moment coming out the hatch and looking down and seeing just my boots and the earth below, and it was such a spectacular and beautiful sight. It was really quite overwhelming, and we went out and did the job that we had to do, and we're lucky enough to have some time to enjoy the view as well.
Christina and Jessica were part of the first 50% female astronaut class at NASA, but women have been performing spacewalks since 1984. Russian cosmonaut Svetlana Savitskaya spacewalked that July, and NASA astronaut Catherine Sullivan spacewalked in October that year. Here's Jessica again.
From the very beginning of our training, we were all treated the same way. So when I went out the door for the first time, I was thinking about all of these things about doing my first spacewalk. I wasn't thinking, was I going out the door with a man or with a woman? That really didn't matter to me in my eyes, because everybody up here right now has been held to that same standard and has received the same training.
During the walk, the pair repaired one of the space station's power control units, successfully completing both mission and milestone.
Beth Timmins. And that's all from us for now, but there'll be an updated version of the Global News podcast later. I'm Oliver Conway. Until next time, goodbye.